The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 6 in the Gateless Gate. The world-honored one holds up a flower. At a gathering on Vulture Peak, the world-honored one held up a flower and showed it to the assembly. At that moment, everyone in the assembly was silent, except Mahakashapa, who broke into a smile. The world-honored one said, "I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, the subtle and wondrous gate to the Dharma, the special transmission outside of scriptural teachings not established on words and language. I now entrust it to Mahakashapa." Wu Men's comment: the golden-faced Gautama behaved as if no one were capable among his assembly. He turned the noble into the lowly and sold dog meat and advertised it as mutton, proclaiming it as marvelous. If the whole assembly had smiled, how would the Buddha have passed on the treasury of the true Dharma eye? If Mahakashapa had not smiled, how would the Buddha have transmitted the treasury of the true Dharma eye? If you say that the treasury of the true Dharma eye can be transmitted, then the old golden-faced man would just be deceiving villagers. If you say that it cannot be transmitted, then why did he approve of Mahakashapa? And the verse: holding up the flower, the fox's tail is already revealed. Kashapa's smile: humans and devas are all bewildered. So this is a slightly different translation of our Boundless Way version of this koan. It comes from the Chinese-American Chan teacher Guo Gu, who is someone who actually understands and can read Chinese. And it's nice to see that there's not that much different in the version that we inherited from our Japanese ancestors, specifically from Yamada Roshi. This case always brings to mind for me a movie that I loved when it first came out. It's worn a little thin over the years, but it's called Monty Python's The Life of Brian. If you know this movie, then you know, but maybe you don't know, that Brian was born in a stable next door to Jesus. And all his life, he was considered next door to the Messiah. And people worshiped him mistakenly because he was just an ordinary person. In fact, a very bumbling ordinary person. And there are many favorite moments for me in Life of Brian. But I think my favorite is when people are listening to Jesus give the Sermon on the Mount. And whenever I hear this koan, I imagine myself in that visual picture when I'm listening to Shakyamuni Buddha from the back, from all of the assembled group of people who came to hear Shakyamuni, just like all the assembled group of people who came to hear Jesus preaching. And in the Life of Brian, one person says to another, "What's he saying?" "Oh, he's saying, 'Blessed are the cheesemakers.'" "And what does that mean?" And the person who heard "blessed are the cheesemakers," which is a mishearing, of course, of "blessed are the peacemakers," says, "Well, it's a metaphor. It refers to anyone who creates dairy products." So this is how it works, isn't it? I can feel the presence on that peak, Mount Gradrakuta, which is a translation of the Sanskrit for Vulture Peak, a place where apparently Shakyamuni Buddha used to give talks and Lots and lots of people, just like with Jesus, lots and lots of people there hearing him, and I'm positive mishearing him. And I always seat myself among that assembly. I wonder what it would have been like to be there to hear the Buddha himself, who somebody said to me, and I did warn you in a Doksan that I would probably use this in my talk, but here it is. The Buddha, who had this wonderful experience, and then just like all the rest of us neurodiverse people, he just held on to it and blabbed about it for the rest of his life. To understand that we're all like this, we all have divergent brains, we all perceive reality differently. It's really kind of wonderful to accept this about ourselves. There is no one like you anywhere on the planet. You can maybe give yourself a diagnosis, or your doctor can, or you can say, poor me, I have this problem, or wonderful me, I have this great thing about me. All of it is a misunderstanding of the teaching of the Buddha, that everyone, without exception, is already a Buddha, but they haven't maybe realized it yet. When we let the self take prominence in our awareness, then we defend the self with so much energy. But you don't understand. No, really, I'm special. I have special problems, or I have special talents, or whatever it is. My first teacher used to say, no one is special, but everyone is completely unique. What you have to offer the world as a bodhisattva, as an awakened person who practices sincerely, is only yours to offer. And you don't know what it is until the dressing of the self, the accoutrements of the self, begin to wear away. And they do. But who you are, your body, your personality, your history, that never goes away. Instead of pretending that there's nobody here, we have to realize that what we are dressed in, the self that we enact in the world, is the only vehicle we have for reaching out, like the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, Guanyin, the reaching out of those healing hands to a world that is suffering and has always been suffering. And as long as human beings are on the planet, until the moment when the sun does its supernova thing, and none of us will be here for that, probably, I doubt it, but you never know with modern technology. Until that moment when we're all burned up in the kalpa fire, this is what we're stuck with. We're stuck with it, and we're gifted with it. It's so important to know this. Only you can save the world in your own particular way. What is that? So this koan is so interesting. We forgot to mention, Alan and Michael and I, on the first night, why David Roshi's not here. He is actually in Toledo, Ohio, at the Toledo Zen Center, witnessing a ceremony for a teacher there, a friend of ours, who is receiving Inca Shomei, which is the final stage of transmission, not a guaranteed one. Even if you receive transmission, Denkai, Denbo, they're called, and become a sensei, you may not receive Inca Shomei. That allows you to be called a Roshi, at least in our boundless way of understanding these things. And this person was a student of mine and a student of James Ford's, and then a student of our own husband. And then he decided, after we didn't give her transmission, to give her transmission. And now he's giving her Inca Shomei. And so she's being held up on Vulture Peak, the Vulture Peak in Toledo, Ohio. And she's being celebrated And it seemed important that somebody from Boundless Way go out to participate in that, since she is part of our lineage tradition as well. And so I'd like to say that David and I flipped a coin, but really I didn't want to go. I just wanted to stay here and be with this crowd, my crowd in a way. Maybe my ego got in the way and I just thought, I don't know if I want to go to Vulture Peak in Toledo, Ohio. I'd rather be here in Vulture Peak in Worcester, Massachusetts. Anyway, David was really excited to go. I haven't heard much from him, but he has been texting a little bit saying, it's a lot. And I'll find out later what that really means. So here we are on Vulture Peak, and all of you in the crowd may be wondering, what is going on here with transmission in general, which seems to single out individuals, which seems to be a kind of vehicle for making the ego even stronger and bigger. A friend of mine recently who came to David's book reading launch was shocked that there was any kind of celebration of the self in Zen. And this is a tricky thing. Her spiritual practice is about, she said, I'm trying to remember the word she used, but it was something like demolishing the self. We don't do that in Zen. We realize that the self is empty. We realize that the self is simply a vehicle for being active in the world, from enacting the activity body, the nirmanakaya, in the world. The self helps us get up in the morning, and it knows to go to the bathroom and to get dressed and to get coffee or tea and come to the zendo and make bows and sit down. It's useful, but we also warn against the self being in charge. We sometimes talk about host and guest in Zen. And usually when we're growing up and learning how to be a person, developing our ego, which is so important in Western psychology, it means a little bit something different than what we talk about. But it's a useful thing to let the self develop and have this unique way of being us. But it becomes the host. It gets to be in charge of everything. And we are the guests, the helpless guests, in the inner puppet show of the self, as another person and I were talking about. So how is it that the reversal happens? How does the host become the guest? How does the guest become the host? And of course, it is a product of our sincere dedication and trust in this great way, which has been on the planet for only 2.5 millennia, nothing compared to the life on Earth, even the life of human beings. And the Zen practices have only been around really for about 1,000, maybe 1,500 years. And yet I look back at the pseudo history, really, as Alan pointed out yesterday in his wonderful and comprehensive talk, we don't really know what happened on Vulture Peak. We don't even know what happened at the Sermon on the Mount, even, which was 500 years later. But human beings love to tell stories and make up stories. And this is one of the great stories of our tradition of Zen, not necessarily of Buddhism, as Alan said. It's an important story because, as with any koan, there is an opportunity to identify with everyone in the koan. This is what you're asked to do. For those of you who do koan practice, you know this already, I hope, that every person in the koan, every single person is you. How wonderful. How wonderful to be Shakyamuni Buddha. Why not? The golden-faced Gautama, as Wu Men calls him. In another translation, which Gugo told me is a bad translation, but I kind of like parts of it, it says he is the earth-faced one. He is the ordinary one, the mud-faced one. I like that. Not golden sounds so highfalutin. And there's a lot of highfalutin stuff in this koan, as we know, when he gives transmission in front of everybody to Mahakashapa and says all this glorious language, la, 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 you know, all this. Something else is happening with our great ancestor. He walked the earth just like we do. He got up in the morning and his own ego self knew to take him to pee and poop, just like us. Really, the Buddha. He did this. He got sick. He got old. He died pretty much alone. Even after he gave transmission to Mahakashapa, Mahakashapa went off and started his own thing. This is what people do. The Buddha was not glorious or glorified all his life, according to the legends. Of course, we don't really know. But we revere him because he kept pointing things out that have so much resonance, moment after moment, for me anyway, I hope for you, to my own life and my perception of the way things are. What a gift. 2,600 years ago, whether he existed or not, I feel so lucky to have encountered his teachings. And then there's Mahakashapa, who is the one disciple in the whole gang. And he had a lot of disciples who, according to Zen tradition, received transmission. The reality, or at least the pseudo reality, is that there were a lot of other people in his Sangha who became great teachers and wandered the earth and wrote great stuff and poems and sermons and all kinds of things. But we revere Mahakashapa because he's our ancestor, just like I revere my grandparents and my great-grandparents and the stories that have come down to me about them. He's our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And the Buddha is his father in the lineage. It's great to be able to point to this, even if it's not true. So then there are all the people in the crowd mishearing the message, or hearing it and it touches their hearts and it breaks them open, but they are not recognized. They don't smile in a way that the Buddha can see. There's some fault in the transmission of understanding here among the great crowd. And I feel that it's so important that we can move back and forth between the Buddha's experience, his inner experience, and I want to talk about that in a moment, the Mahakashapa's experience, which I also want to mention, and all these vast hordes of people saying, did you hear what he just said? Did you do? What is the deal with the flower? I don't get it. To embrace that part of ourselves, the one who's puzzled, the one who doesn't get it, who says nothing, who does nothing. This is a valuable part of all of us, as we know, because we do favor beginner's mind and not knowing in Zen. Everyone in that crowd who stayed silent, and there are many koans where nobody says anything and people are just silent. And often the teacher, this happens a lot with Yun Men's teaching, the Chan Chinese teacher, where he says something, nobody responds, and then he says something in response. He takes the other side of it. He becomes both host and guest, we might say. And this is our job, of course, to break down the boundaries between this and that, you and me, good and bad, not jettison them, not get rid of them, keep them around just like we keep the self around because they're useful. But it's so important to see how all of these things are constructions and not to let them be in charge, not to let them be the host and control us. As guests of a deluded self, it's our job to change seats. In the transmission ceremony, as we do it in Boundless Way, there are three, as I said, the first two, Denkai and then Denbo, And then Inkashome, in Denkai and Denbo, these are private ceremonies. And one of the things in Denkai, when people become Dharma heirs, is that there's a moment in this private ceremony where the teacher and the student change seats. It's so important, that moment. It often is a moment that touches those of us in the ceremony. It seems so true to keep changing seats. If we think about this from our own parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, all children eventually change seats with their parents. No matter what happens, we become adults. We take the seat of adults, and we find a way to live our lives authentically. And this is what happens in transmission. We look for it. We look for people to show up in this way. It's not something you can put on a list and check the boxes for. It's a sense that I have as a teacher that the person sitting in front of me knows what I know. And then I watch as that person, whoever it is, begins to enact that in their life. And then it's time to name them, maybe, as a practice leader or an assistant teacher or a senior assistant teacher. And then maybe to give transmission, Denkai, Dharma holder. And then maybe to give Denbo. I say maybe, right? Because we don't know what's going to happen. Then that person becomes a sensei. These are continuous reversals of host and guest, of parent and child, of teacher and student. They're flexible, they move. Sometimes after I receive transmission, I still sometimes wake up in the morning and feel this way. Worst teacher on the planet. You know, I get the prize. You can see how there's the specialness again. Whether I'm the best or the worst, that's the delusion. It's only in certain roles having to open my mouth, in certain roles having to meet people. And it's this meeting people, going back to Shakyamuni and Mahakashapa, that touches me the most about this koan. I am so lucky. I get to meet all of you face to face, all of the faces in the crowd, all of the Mahakashapas, all of the anonymous people here on Vulture Peak. And sometimes, and this is one of the great joys of my life, as I misquoted Rumi yesterday, what is the true connection between people? I think it's more like when the same knowing opens a door between them, then they are called to be companions. Rare, unusual, doesn't happen with everybody. And often it happens for me. We call it in Zen the call and response. In Dokusan, the person walks in the door and shuts the door or bows first and then shuts the door, whatever, all these forms. And even in that walking in, even in the shutting of the door, even in the bowing, is the call. And I wait. My name is Melissa. My practice is Mu. And then what is it? Can this person sitting in front of me see the offering of the teachings, experience, comprehend them in their own unique way? Not special, remember, but unique. I watch all the defendedness around the self because we all have it. People come in and they think they're supposed to be a certain way or say a certain thing or hide the true essence nature that is the Buddha nature that appears to me as a light or a small flame. It's undeniable. It's one of the things that I think led me on the path of being a teacher. Being a teacher is not for everybody, thank goodness. Although, on the other hand, everybody's a teacher. Everything is a teacher. Everything is demonstrating its Buddha nature all the time. And inanimate objects, animals, plants, birds, they do it without reflection and without defensiveness. They don't have egos to defend. At least I don't think so. That cawing of the crow yesterday during our Om Nam, I don't know if it came through on Zoom, but it penetrated my heart. The crow was singing along with us. At least it seemed that way to me. I doubt that the crow said, "Ooh, what are they doing? Let me join in." But its own heart opened, and what can it do but go, caw, caw, caw. That's the crow's nature. And how do we express our nature, our true nature, as we say, which is beyond ego and defending the ego, beyond hiding? One of the phrases in koans is as of praise for people in all these stories that we've inherited. Someone says, completely exposed. This is what begins to happen. This is what happened, I believe, with this lovely fairy tale of a teacher sitting in front of a huge crowd holding up a flower. The flower, which is just one element in the great vast universe of things expressing the Dharma. It's not about the flower. I hope you understand that. He could have held up, and many Zen teachers did, as Alan was pointing out yesterday, many things, a stick, a whisk, a shit stick, 3 pounds of flax, you know, who cares what it is? Everything is it. Everything is expressing the Buddha Dharma, so he can only show one tiny part of it. We say the snake shows its tail. The tail of a snake, you know, if you see the snake's tail, that there's a snake there. You know, if you see horns coming over a hill, that there's a cow or a bull or some animal with horns there. And in this translation, which leads me to believe that who knows what the translation is originally that we took as a snake, the fox shows its tail. You see the tail of a fox, you know it. The other day, David and I, every once in a while, we're visited by mice in our cottage, in our hermitage. And we saw a mouse run by, and we chased it into the pantry where it sat quivering behind a bunch of paper bags. And I said to him, "Where is it? Where is it?" And he said, "You can just see the tail. The mouse can't help it." You show yourself in every single moment. The tail reveals everything. The flower reveals everything. And Mahakashapa, just through karma, through conditions and history, his own history, one of the Kashapa brothers, there were a bunch of Kashapas, and he was the oldest, so he was called Big Kashapa, Mahakashapa. He's the one. He got it. He laughed. He smiled. Who knows? He cracked open, as Alan pointed out. This cracking is part of many of the translations, including this one from Chinese. And the Buddha recognized it, the call and the response. Sometimes the teacher calls out. There's another koan where the teacher calls his jisha, and the jisha says yes, and the teacher calls again, and the jisha says yes, and the teacher calls again, and the jisha says yes. And then the teacher says, "I thought that I was ungrateful to you, but I see you're ungrateful to me." What? I thought we were all supposed to be grateful. What is this ungrateful? How could that be praise? Koans upend our certainty about the way things are and who we are. This is why we practice being everyone in the koan. This is why we practice being awake in this world to the suffering of everyone. This is why our heart turns when we hear a newspaper report or on the radio or we see something on TV or on the internet. We stay sharp. We stay awake so that we don't dull down and go, oh yeah, you know, this kid in Gaza, that family in Ukraine, this and that and this and that. No, no. Oh, terrible suffering. Every single one is someone who grew up with an ego, a self, unique. Every person who's killed in the world, who's attacked, who's tortured and raped and bombed, every person so valuable. Never forget that. This is what Guanyin knows of Avalokiteshvara. This is why she has 1,000 arms and 1,000 eyes, because there's so much suffering and so much to do to meet it. This is the call and response of suffering. So the flower, the smile, just one example. Please remember that if you are serious about being a Zen student, and I always remember my daughter when she went to college her freshman year, her roommate described herself as a serious violinist, and we joked, really? You never smile? She didn't get the joke. A sincere Zen student, a dedicated, devoted Zen student. If you're thinking, oh no, that's not me, well, sorry, too late. You're here. You're on Zoom. You're maybe somewhere in a car listening to the podcast. Who knows? Just by showing up, you're like that flower. A demonstration of every single awakened thing in the universe. And all we can do in response is smile. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll do our U shape. Taking a moment to settle in. And notice if you're moved to say something, to ask a question, make a comment, anything. Anything. Yeah, we've got Modu, so let's hand the microphone to Modu.
Thank you for your talk. I really liked it when you made that special moment for Mahakashyapa with Buddha, not so special at the same time. I don't know why it touched my heart. Because, it was probably special for him and for Buddha, but, what about the rest of the crowd and the story that was said? And, I think it was so important to know that. I think that aspect of, these transmissions and, how somebody holds a flower and, somebody smiles and then, there's this show. This world is all about show and pretension, almost it feels like. And, so, I mean, we do want that, though the ego does want that. And sometimes I think what my Zen practice would be if it was not for this show. That's a good question, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know if either of you have something. Just quickly, this is why we don't want to get rid of the ego. Demolish it, I think might have been the word that my friend used. It's useful. It got us here.
Yeah, and we tend to use the word not show, but we use the word presentation. So holding the flower is a complete presentation, and smiling is a complete presentation. So what does it mean to show your entire self holding nothing back, hiding nothing, as Melissa said during your Dharma talk, fully exposed, completely exposed. This is a hard thing for we human beings to do. It's been really hard for me. You know, my 15 years with Boundless Way Zen have been largely about learning to present myself more fully and let you all see me and be completely exposed. And I've seen others of you go through the same process, and we're going through it together now. So show, I like that. And it could also sound like sort of like showmanship, showpersonship. presentation, you know, maybe more pointing towards revealing the self and holding nothing back.
You know, 15 years ago, or let's say 13 years ago, when I first started coming to Sesshin, we had a lot more people in this room. It was sometimes up to 40, and some people in the hall, and it was really easy for me to hide. I would be like way over there, and I, to whose benefit, you know, I really, it's been a difficult journey for me to come up to the front of the room and speak and do things. But I'm the better for it. And I really think the world is the better for it. And that's part of the ego coming forward saying, and as a tool coming forward and helping me.
Thank you.
Yeah, nobody on screen, so let's go to Ray.
Thank you, Melissa. I loved your talk. And thinking about my own life and where it might, you know, might apply and does apply. One of the things that I think gets in the way is this ego, or as I see it, my story that I hold on to, that the kind of person I feel I am and needs to be seen and needs to be acknowledged. For example, I've had a difficult early childhood, and so did my younger brother, and he has great anger towards me for having abandoned him. And my story is, well, I had good reason to do it. I had to take care of my, you know, this. And once I let go of my story and just got to see his story, and within his story, it makes complete sense for him to dislike me, not want to tolerate being in the same room with me. And once I can accept that, without having to defend this ego, that this the one who, you know, wants to be seen or wants to be acknowledged, or the story that wants to be, you know, that I hold on to, once I let go of that, then nothing to hold on to. So I'm amazed at how much I hold on to my story. That's it.
Yeah. And I think all of us, right, are like that. We hold tight. You know, back when I taught stress reduction, we used to sometimes give out cartoons to people. And some of you may know this cartoon of a man holding on to a big boulder and sinking to the bottom of the ocean. And the caption is, my stone, I couldn't live without my stone. And then the second panel, same picture. And yet, he's drowning. And we're drowning. We really are. We hold so tight to the familiar. This is true. You know, Freud called it the repetition compulsion, didn't he? And so we're constantly repeating the same things just so that fit in our story and ignoring everything else. Just the world is vast and wide. You know, but we just, it has to fit the story of the self. I think you're pointing this out. And it's true, it's universal. I never met anybody who didn't cling to a story about the self. Thank you. Let's go to Anne on camera.
Yeah, I almost don't know what I'm going to say, because this koan did and still bothers me, even though I've thought about it now with all three of you. And it's not just about the ego, what we think of ourselves. It's also about judgment and what we think other people are thinking about us. And sometimes we're right. And Zen's got a lot of judgment in it. And it's a hard thing to navigate, both what you think of yourself and what you're perceiving is coming back at you. And I don't know what to do with it, so I'm going to stop.
Yeah. I don't know if Zen has a lot of judgment in it. I would say Zen has a lot of discernment, right? And that word to me, it's just like what Alan was saying about showing versus what was the word you used? Not demonstrate.
Presentation.
Presentation, right? Words are important. Because judge sounds condemning and it's all about right and wrong. But discerning is very important in Zen. You're right. We're always looking as teachers to see, to discern what does this person need? What teaching would be a good match for somebody? And it can feel because the world is full of judgment, like another judgment on the self. Yeah, the opinions of others. Yes.
And we're all human, and we're coming in, and this practice of Zen isn't something that exists outside of our human experience. It's a path that we take, but humans are judgmental. Can't get around that. And if you want to look for someone who's not judgmental, I don't think you'll find them. So, this is how we work, and this is how the best we can do.
Yeah, I'd also like to add this. And for many years I was a classroom teacher, and part of my job was sometimes telling students that they were wrong in class discussions. And the students felt really judged, and they didn't like it until I learned something from a center that helped you learn how to teach better. And what I learned was this phrase, if you're never wrong, you can't learn anything. And I would tell that to my students early on in the term. One of them would be embarrassed about being wrong. I say, no, don't be embarrassed. If you're never wrong, you can't learn anything. So if every time you were doing koan work as teachers, we just said, yeah, I like that. That's okay. You would never your sense of the Dharma would never get deeper, would never get broader. And so we sometimes say wrong. And that's not judgment so much as trying to open things up for each one of you. For we also are wrong, and believe me, we let each other know.
Yes, Eugenia.
Thank you for this wonderful talk, Melissa. It made me think also a lot about the talk of Alan yesterday about is that story necessarily true? And I started thinking about the convergence between mythology and story. And if some stories have been around for a long time, perhaps there is something to that story if they have been retold. And for example, about the prophet who leaves home and becomes enlightened. This story exists in so many religious traditions. And about your talk, Melissa, about these unwanted visitors, about these shadow sides of ourselves that we encounter. So they are the messengers of enlightenment, I think, when we encounter the fool or the joker, as Jung would call it, or all those aspects that we don't want to see that are part of our self, which is made of multiple selves. And yeah, I also love Rumi, and I was thinking about that poem, There is a Field Beyond Wrongdoing and Right Doing, and I'll meet you there. So
Yes,
thank you so much.
that's right. Yeah, so there is right and wrong, and there's also a field out beyond all ideas in the translation that I know of right doing and wrongdoing. Our ideas do pin us down, don't they? And I love what you're saying, Eugenia, about It's very similar to what Alan was saying. Our mistakes are what did you say? They're messengers of enlightenment. Right, right. How wonderful that everything can be used in this way. And there are, I judge people out in the world too. I can think of three politicians just like that all over the world. And I once said this in a talk at a university. I don't really know them. I actually have not sat down in a room with any of them. I don't know what's going on for them. So that's my story, right? Of if only you would stop, blah, blah, blah. They're necessary. And I think at a certain point when they start to thin out as stories, and we see them as myths, as actually this is how human beings think about the world, there's a usefulness. Again, everything is useful. Yeah, thank you. Pierce.
Thank you, Melissa, for that wonderful talk. I'm still puzzling over Wu Men's verse and those questions that he asks, which really sort of throw me for a loop. What if Maha Kassiapa didn't smile? What if everybody smiled? And so I don't quite know what to make of them, except that in regard to what you're saying, I think it's clarified it a little bit that, there is no one way to respond in this situation. Maha Kassiapa responded in his way, but we're not required to have a revelation if somebody holds up a flower or an old boot. We're required to respond as ourselves, to expose ourselves or show ourselves in response to the unique situation that arises. And this I call, I call it for myself, the mercy of Zen. It's not requiring me to follow the program, but it requires something else entirely. Which Michael is saying there, this isn't something, a way or a path outside of us. It's something that is actually inside of us, which has to come out. So I don't know, maybe you can shed some more light on movement's questions. I don't know, they're still kind of rattling around in my head. But anyway, that's my current.
Pierce, I do have something come up around it, which is if you're exposed to enough koans, especially in the Wu Men Guan, Wu Men, it always seems to me, is baiting us with right and wrong, just because we'll fall into that trap. We do it here all the time. It's just constant human being stuff. Sometimes I'm wrong, they're right. Sometimes they're wrong, I'm right. Sometimes this is wrong, that's, all the time. So what if A? Oh, but what if B? Oh, and then the mind gets caught. The mind loves dualities, the way we're, the brain works. It just splits everything all the time. And, the instruction here is don't be fooled. Be fooled, especially, that's in the comment, I think, when he says, what if this happened? What if that happened? In the second koan, in the Wu Men Guan, the first one is Mu, if you don't know. The second one is Baijiang's fox. And, this guy was turned into a fox for, 500 lifetimes. And the student comes up and says, well, wait a minute, what if that hadn't happened? It's the same thing. This is we speculate. Wait a minute. So I think to really love that, not getting it enough to have it also become spacious, like the self becomes spacious. All our ideas can trap us.
Thank you, Pierce. I really appreciate what you're just saying, because for me, it lays out how we work with koans. Because it's difficult because we have a koan curriculum that where you present an answer that the teacher says yes or no. So it can appear like that the point of working on a koan is to get to one answer and then that's it. And you suddenly get a pat on the shoulder and you can go to the next one. That's not the point. The point is to wake up. And if you come to this insight, you could get every single koan correct, quote unquote, and not have an awakening. It would be a waste of your time. But if you get all them wrong, but you became you woke up to the essential nature of who you are, that would be worth every wrong answer you ever came up with.
Thank you. I think I saw Jenny's hand go up. Can you bring the microphone up? Then Jenny will meet you.
Thanks for the talk, Melissa. There was so much there. And thinking of the Life of Brian thing, there was an interview I read with this man that left his regular Western existence to live in a tree in British Columbia. And he was saying the difference between the totem poles that you find in the woods and the totem poles that you find in the Alaska State Museum. And it's like dead in the museum. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking how I do that with my own life. Like, it's the Pacific Ocean. It's the Appalachian Trail. It's the ear infection. and people love to do that. It's the flower. and even dogs do it. Just they'll take something special happen and they make a ritual out of it. Want to do it again and again. That's what came to mind.
Yeah. You?
Yeah, I want to hear more about the totem pole in the forest. You know, what's that? Is that one that's not been ritualized, that's not been set apart? And so what is that in your life? What's your wild totem pole?
Yeah, that's like authentic. It's growing moss and it's in this place on the coastline, not taken into a room somewhere, right? And that's the first time, the time that you take and put in the museum.
And I think I'm wondering if Alan's asking, can you give an example in your own life? What is a living totem pole for you?
Sashin at Boundless Ways and Temple.
Good answer. Yeah. So maybe somebody else, some Bix.
Yeah, so I guess I'm thinking about these stories, and I mentioned at the beginning that I had this story that I had, like, how was my practice going well or whatever. And that was like a really fun story. You know what I mean? Like, I was really loving that story, even though I knew it was going to collapse at a certain point. But, you know, I guess I'm just, and what the Sashin has been so far is just like that story getting totally, and my emotions regarding that story and all of this stuff that I had built up around it getting like totally demolished. And it has not been fun. I guess all this stuff that the ego builds up, I'm like still very much learning how to navigate that in a way that I didn't know that I would still have to do. Yes.
After what? That you would still have to do?
Yeah, like I don't know, you know, certain times, especially when those stories come up, like when I think my practice is going well, it's like part of that is like, this is going to last forever.
Right.
You know what I mean? Even though there's a voice in the back of my head that's like, no, this will end soon. But then it's like, no, just keep doing this thing that you're doing to make your practice go well. And then you won't ever have to deal with this ever again.
Yeah. The ongoing delusion of the Zen student, right? That it's going to last. I have an insight. Everything opened. I saw the flower, whatever it is. and that's going to last forever. Yeah. And of course, nothing lasts forever. But, or I should say, and these moments when we feel like, oh, I see, I get it. One of the things about koans is that you have an opportunity, thousands of opportunities to go, oh, I get it. You know, this isn't such a big deal for me anymore. It's so clear. And then boom, we get another koan that isn't clear. It's beautiful. Yeah. So the ongoing expanding of that delusion, the narrowing, I've got it all together too. It's never together. What is it now? What is it now? Yeah. Thank you. Dawn, I saw your hand go up before. Do you still want to offer something? You don't have to.
Yeah, sure. Just so many thoughts about all of this, but I guess I think my hand went up on the one, a thought about stories, and I love stories, and I love the human tradition to tell and share stories. And I get the sense that it's like part of us as an animal to tell stories. Mm-hmm. And good, you know, and the stories that I guess Zen has kind of encouraged me to look for and that I find the most rewarding are ones that open me rather than close.
Yes.
And sometimes it's hard to tell when a story is closing me. And I guess that's my practice is I'm finding what opens. And then sometimes a story that opened me doesn't do that anymore. And I have to move on from it. Or, you know, maybe I share it with someone else. But I don't know. Yeah, those were the thoughts that were rolling around in my head. Thank you.
Beautiful. I'm glad I asked you. Do you want Gus to say anything?
Yeah, I just want to say how deeply moved I was by that, Dawn, because it reminded me of why I came to Buddhism, because it was a story that tore me right open. Mm. And you know, earlier religious stories that I had tried on for size or had been handed to me, you know, by my environment and my parents did not. And so just really, I love that way of putting it, really honoring that. Thank you, Dawn.
Thank you. So yeah, let's take Laura and then Esther. I had her hand up to put it down. So we'll check in with you in a moment.
I've been thinking a lot about how weird it is that we're all here together. Because it's not like we necessarily like each other. And I feel like most people who have sleepover parties this long, like kind of like each other. And I'm not saying we don't, we might enjoy some of each other's company, but like I've been thinking about the Rumi quote. It's kind of like out beyond like liking and not liking each other. Is this Sashin place? And here we are. But you know, I'm just kind of touched by that. You know, it's also not a place where we come to be nice to each other, whether or not we like each other. I think like there's like kindness here, but we're also, I wouldn't say mean, but we hold each other to so many things, and it can be like so alarming, because I think a lot of other practices I feel like are kind of putting on, or when I think of like church or some of these like, oh, hi, like let's all just be really nice to each other. I just keep getting so like moved by how this feels so different. And I've been thinking about the vultures, like all the people there, and this one person who gets, you know, the affection of Buddha and of Shakyamuni and gets the transmission. But I wonder, like, if all the other people also get it, like if they're just sitting, like how could they not? And that's, I guess,
yeah,
my question. Like, even, no matter what's happening here, it's like kindness, niceness, transmission, not like something is being received.
Well, a couple of things about that, because Alan talked about that yesterday, right? That everybody really everybody in that assembly received something. It was universal, right? And then the other side of it is there are many koans, and Woman has a lot of his verses are about this, about how transmission is really a terrible thing, right? Because it leads to all this responsibility. And it's a responsibility for something that can't be identified. So it's a constant practice. I know I can speak for myself, but I think it's true for the other teachers in Boundless Way. It's its own koan, right? So Woman keeps pointing to it, the family shame, he calls it in one place. And that's really important. Yeah, you can.
I think what you're saying too, really what you're saying speaks to the heart of what Don was saying, this story making. I mean, this is a story. And in a story, you have this, the protagonist and the person who's accepting this, but there's so many other aspects to a story. And this story teaches us something, but we as human beings can enter the story in all sorts of ways and not be fixed on one particular way or you know, pulled in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. And right, you know, the story of the self and these narratives that we create about the world, to step into them, not being fooled that they are some real true thing, right? You know, that they're useful. They're so useful, as Don was pointing out. And we don't want to just abandon them. That would be a life without cheesemakers. Right? I don't want to live that life. Right? It's great. The associative mind. Yippee. And don't be fooled. Right? Always.
And this is building on what Melissa said earlier in response to you. That, you know, as we do this play of identifications with people in the koan, I was imagining a different senior student of Buddha who, you know, after all this is said about Mahakashyapa, says, whoa, I almost smiled. I really dodged a bullet.
That's great. Yeah. Near miss. Yeah. Oh, I think I just, you know, the next transmission in our lineage was to Ananda, who wondered with Mahakashyapa. So, you know, you got transmission from the, but did you get anything else? And this happens through many stories too. This is a big part of it. What happened here? And yikes. And Ananda doesn't even know he gets transmission in that story. That's another wonderful story. Like, what? Yep, you got it. I do? What? What just happened here? Yeah, it's beautiful. Ananda's my hero. Yeah, thanks so much. And Esther, did you want to say something? You had your hand up and put it down too. You have to unmute yourself.
I'm not sure. I feel like the words and the dialogue have kind of ended on some kind of level. So maybe not. No.
Okay. Great. So without Esther to finish and complete, she ended it, but I would like to be the one to do it. Just because I do have that transmission. Is there anybody else who wants to say something before we follow Esther into silence and stillness? It's okay to disagree. Okay, then Esther has it. Thank you, Esther.